Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kalik, and this is Dispatches. As Biden and his spokespeople continue to justify Israel's depravity, arm it without conditions, and use America's veto power to prevent a ceasefire, many are wondering if it will cost Biden the election and how it might change the consciousness of certain American voters, as many are traumatized and horrified by the live-streamed U.S.-backed Israeli genocide that continues to dominate their social media feeds without end. But the ruling class is in total denial, as they portray Israel as the victim, pretend there won't be any consequences for the Democrats in a place like Michigan, and ignore the fact that the genocide in Gaza could awaken a kind of anti-imperialist fervor among some Americans, as represented by Aaron Bushnell, who lit himself on fire outside the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., to protest the U.S.-backed genocide in Gaza. So they try to control the narrative, accuse their detractors of anti-Semitism, bully people into voting blue no matter who, and harass and intimidate students on college campuses. Joining me to discuss this and more is Prem Tucker, politics reporter for The Intercept. But before we jump into it, this is just the first half of this episode. The second half is available for Breakthrough News members only. You can become a member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. Prem, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you on, and the timing couldn't be better considering we just saw the Michigan primary for the Democrats and Republicans take place. But the more interesting primary was that of the Democrats. And you actually had covered this before the primary took place, but basically there was this whole situation where people were going to vote uncommitted as like a protest vote against Biden because of his genocide in Gaza. Obviously, Michigan is home to, I think, the biggest Arab population in the country, particularly in Dearborn. And it looks like uncommitted votes in Michigan surpassed 100,000. So people took that very seriously. That made up a little over 13% of the vote total. Biden came away winning with about 81% of the vote. And then there was like 3% here or there for the various third party, or not third party candidates, sorry, for the various other candidates running, like Marianne Williamson, who aren't getting that much attention, but that's a whole nother story. But can you, I guess, start off by explain what's happening here with these uncommitted votes and why this matters, why this outcome matters when we think about the general election?
Yeah, so I think firstly, what's important to recognize is that this campaign to get people to sort of protest vote began in earnest about 3 weeks ago, which coincidentally was functionally when Marianne Williamson dropped out. Nevertheless, she still beat Dean Phillips, but that's just kind of a fun little sidebar. But yeah, this campaign began in earnest about 3 weeks ago, of course, with a shoestring budget relative to, you know, any more organized campaign that takes place over months. And for 100,000 people to come out, and of course, you know, some of these people might have voted uncommitted regardless, even before this campaign, but still over 100,000 people coming out voting for not the incumbent is pretty significant. And some people are pointing to results such as, for instance, in 2012, I believe during that primary, about 10% of people voted uncommitted versus the rest of the folks who voted for Obama. And, you know, it's hard to sort of get into the psychology of every single primary voter at every single cycle. I think, for instance, a counter to that would be, for example, in 2020, the Republican primary, where there was, of course, in many ways, a pretty polarizing, unpopular candidate. Less than 5% of voters in Michigan voted for someone other than Donald Trump, as in for an uncommitted. So, you know, you can always find a different sort of comparison. I think when you think of this specific primary in the context of the fact that it is already a very close race just by the polls, when you go by the fact that for the Democrats, for Biden, right now, every single vote matters. This is supposed to be a campaign of addition, not sort of assumption or presumption that you can get by without certain people, because, of course, the polls are not God. The polls can often be wrong or not exactly right, or the media narratives around them cannot be necessarily fully accurate. But nonetheless, they are a tool that we have. And so far, a lot of polls are not necessarily encouraging for Biden in an election that otherwise, you know, you'd think that hopefully it'd be okay. I don't want to use the phrase Gaza aside, but taking the very dramatic consequences of Gaza to the side for a moment, the Republicans for every election since 2016 have been hurt by a very debilitating effect that Trump brings to the party and the broader electorate. They've been hurt by their attacks on abortion and now IVF. They've been, you know, hurt by their broad sweeping attacks on all sorts of people in this country, different racial backgrounds, different gender sexuality backgrounds, and so on. That's sort of a basic premise that that is a part of this party now. And so for the opposition party, ostensibly, to be in such a close race, even, let's say, only 3% more voters relative to 2012 came out to vote for uncommitted, in a very sort of generous conservative way of putting it, to accept the sort of critics of the uncommitted campaign. That's not good when you need to be getting every single vote possible. So in the most conservative sort of outlook of what happened yesterday, this is not great. In a more just straightforward interpretation, for 100,000 people to vote uncommitted, to actively vote uncommitted instead of just voting for the incumbent on the ticket, that is not a good sign.
And just real quick, for those who are watching who aren't American, because I mean, I think when we're in the American context, we understand the importance of Michigan. Mm-hmm. So for our European viewers, for our Middle Eastern viewers, what is the significance of Michigan when we talk about the swing state situation here?
Yeah, I think Michigan and a few other sort of Midwestern states have become, particularly in the past few cycles, more evidently important because of the way that Donald Trump was able to win some of these in 2016. In 2016, he narrowly beat Hillary Clinton in Michigan, as well as a few other states that Democrats, you know, were kind of assuming in certain ways that they would win because of, you know, past results before that. But now it's become so much clearer that a lot of these states, you know, can be closer. And moreover, not just that, that a lot of these states are in many ways pretty representative of the melting pot that America is. You know, there's all sorts of people in these sort of Midwestern states that kind of are pretty demographically and class representative of America in a lot of ways. You know, there's a lot of labor presence, a lot of workers in these states. There's a lot of people from diverse communities, including, of course, Arab Americans. And so in many ways, it is a determinant of which party, in some ways, at least, a determinant of which party is really speaking to a lot of different groups all at once. And ostensibly are places that Democrats should win in a lot of ways because of the policies that, if they also pursued in earnest, related to, you know, labor equality, racial equality, and so on, would be ones that would really speak to a lot of these people. So I think that's one big reason why. And of course, again, just to reemphasize the more basic point, these states will, in all likelihood or in a high likelihood, determine the outcome of the 2024 election. They are the swing states. They are the key states that, if X candidate can lock up most of them, they'll probably be okay. So it matters both in terms of just electoral politics, but also in terms of the health and the status of a political party, I would say.
Yeah, and so I want to play this clip because I think it's really, really important when we talk about, when we talk about what this could mean in a general election. Because yes, I mean, this particular vote that we're talking about took place in Michigan during a primary, a Democratic primary. So obviously it doesn't mean that all of these 100,000 people who voted uncommitted in Michigan are necessarily going to do that if it comes down to a Biden-Trump election, which it seems like it will. So that said, I think the narrow margins you mentioned are important to understand, because even if 10,000, even if a few thousand vote uncommitted instead of for Biden, that could actually cost the election for Biden if that means a loss of Michigan. I want to play this clip for this seemed to be like a sit down by MSNBC with some Democratic voters. These are five Michigan voters that are, I guess, against Biden now. Let's hear what they had to say.
Is there a pathway forward for you with Biden?
Oh, absolutely not. You cannot keep killing people with our money and just keep thinking that, oh, we are stupid enough to elect you again, because we'll fall in line. We'll forget. This is an insult to me as a voter.
For you, Biden has a pathway forward.
Biden has a pathway forward.
And what does that look like?
That is him calling for a permanent and immediate ceasefire. The straightforward, simple answer for the Biden administration is push for a ceasefire, stop aiding Israel in their war crimes, and I guarantee you there are enough people who would be willing to deal with it and vote for the man. It is, in so many words, insane to me to have the Democratic Party and the Biden administration sit here and essentially say, if Trump happens, it's your fault.
If you don't want a Trump presidency, then are you not worried about what he could do domestically to this country?
I am. You know, it's like a vaccine. I'm willing to take short-term pain for a long-term gain. I'm willing to let go of Joe Biden and oppose Joe Biden, make him a one-term president, punish Joe Biden by making him a one-term president and pairing his loss with the genocide in Gaza.
Why does our democracy, why is having a Trump presidency more important than those people's lives? Yeah. Why is our democracy more important than thousands of men, women, and children being killed?
So I thought that was a really interesting clip because, first of all, I mean, it's MSNBC doesn't want to show those views, but it, because they become so dominant among a certain base of the Democratic Party, they don't have a choice but to. And so we heard one guy say, oh, yeah, yeah, like if he just he needs to call for a ceasefire and a lot of people will still vote for him. And I think that that guy's right. But there's those other people who are like, no, like it's too late. And so I'm just curious, you know, you've been covering this. What's your take on, like, let's say, do you think, and this is really just speculation because we don't actually know, but given what we've seen take place so far in polling, let's say Biden does call for, let's say there is a ceasefire next week. I mean, I think there's still people who are not going to vote for Biden because they watched babies be torn to pieces for 5 months and him support it. What are your thoughts on whether he can actually still get people to vote for him after everything he's done since October 7th?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, that panel, I think, offered actually a pretty good spectrum of ways of looking at it. I think that was, of course, you know, no news panel is ever going to be perfectly representative of anything because just we found five people. Here's what they said. But I did appreciate that all of them had pretty interesting, actually, answers to that question that I think would then lend itself well for other people to kind of chew on these questions, too. I think one challenging aspect of this is that, say, somehow there is indeed some form of a ceasefire soon, which it seems like it is possible, based on messaging, at least. I don't want to, you know, inflate what they have said. But right, let's say at least a temporary ceasefire is accomplished in the next couple of weeks. That means, ideally, a lot more of our colleagues in the media can hopefully get into Gaza and, you know, talk to people about what they've been facing more directly rather than a lot of what we had to do, which is just through phone, through whatever, you know, mechanisms we have to be there on the ground to convey all that has happened, which we've ostensibly not seen everything of, given just the breakdown of communications, the breakdown of the Ministry of Health and other, you know, centers of communication. That's a lot more images for people to see of the travesties that have happened, ostensibly with, you know, if not, you know, American tolerance, indeed American support in many ways financially and on the global stage. And so those images are ones that the administration would have to navigate as well in terms of if this is a temporary ceasefire and people get, especially disenchanted people or concerned people, which there are many, 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 many in this country, even those who might have voted for Biden in the primary, they will have to see those images. And then if they're told it's a temporary ceasefire, then internalize the idea that more of these images will come.
Yeah.
Which is an even more destabilizing experience for a lot of people. Because even of the images we have seen, of course, let alone just the basic numbers, it's horrifying. And so that is one aspect of that, that if there is a temporary ceasefire, I think in many ways, you know, of course, people feel pretty good about that because at a basic level, the violence is stopping. Hopefully this means some form of resolution, at least something better than what is happening now will occur, that will make people feel, of course, a little better than how they probably feel now, naturally. But there will still be those sort of subsequent challenges this administration has to navigate, even just electorally, because the fact of a temporary ceasefire itself can offend a lot of people naturally, because it's like, what do you mean this is a temporary pause or a temporary stop in what you seem to think is bad? Why would you want it to be temporary? The other aspect of that is the following images that we will probably see during that temporary ceasefire.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't really thought about that too much. The fact that once, you know, if a ceasefire actually were to take place, like what would that even really mean? Because we know the Israelis are probably going to continue to like do certain operations, even within the parameters of whatever ceasefire takes hold, if ever. But yeah, there's going to be, I mean, there's so much we don't know, right? Like, especially in the north of Gaza, like people are starving to death. There's been so many massacres that we don't know about. There's like been really horrific sniping incidents we still don't know about, right? There's been so many sieges of like buildings where people have been left to like die and decompose in horrible ways that we still don't know about. And that's going to continue to trickle out when a ceasefire takes hold. And so what's that going to mean for Biden? Meanwhile, you know, I'm really stunned by not like the depravity of the Biden administration anymore, because I get it. Like, I'm just at this point, assume everybody in a position of power is like some opportunistic sociopath, because I just like don't know how else they can do and say what they say. However, I'm shocked by the lack of control over like the PR when it comes to this. I still cannot believe that there are people around Biden allowing things like this to happen. So for those who are just listening and not watching, I'm sure you saw this at some point. This is Biden eating ice cream in front of like reporters and cameras. And let's just listen to what happened here.
Well, I hope by the beginning of the weekend, I mean, the end of the weekend, at least my national security advisor tells me that we're close. It's not done yet. And my hope is by next Monday, we'll have a ceasefire.
Okay, thank you.
So this is Biden literally eating ice cream while he's talking about a potential end of a genocide where children are literally starving. And, you know, people juxtaposed, I'm sure you saw people took that video of him, you know, holding ice cream and juxtaposed it to images of like children desperately trying to get aid, like food aid, at the wall in Rafah. So anyways, this is like a very... like let them eat cake moment, in my opinion. And I just like, I don't know who's in charge of what's coming out of this administration, but it's kind of shocking. I don't know if that shocked you. It shocked me when I saw it, because I was like, do you literally like have not have like a publicist? Like, I'm very confused what's happening here.
Yeah, it was, I think I like many people had a pretty surprised reaction to that, to say the least. I think, to be generous, for this particular instance, I think right when he was doing his interview with comedian Seth Meyers. And so he was asked a question, he decided to answer it while he was eating ice cream. I think it's always good for a question to be answered. I think in that moment, if you're already doing this comedy show, which I think one broader issue with this is that he is currently running to be president again. So I obviously naturally would take these opportunities if he can. I think especially because people are concerned about his age, this is an opportunity to be in sort of an atmosphere of levity to show that, you know, even though he's 81 years old, he's still cogent. He can still joke around and everything, which, you know, whatever someone believes, this is, I believe, you know, why they're doing these kinds of things, despite also not just running for president, being the person at the till of, you know, a disaster that we are, that the United States is implicated in. So that's the broader sort of circumstance of this. So then, of course, he's at this show. Reporters will naturally ask him questions, of course. That's our job. And so here's an opportunity. He's kind of, you know, caught off guard. He's doing this comedy show. Let's ask him this question. And so I think it was unfortunate timing. I think, like, it is interesting that this is one of the first times we got, like, a somewhat more definitive answer to the question when he's eating ice cream. Like, for instance, I'm no publicist. I'm no politician. I don't know anything. I'm just a guy. But if I'm in the situation where it's like, I'm eating ice cream and I apparently have a more serious answer to this question now, maybe I say we have more news that we'll announce tomorrow on that, or something along those lines. That if you're in this sort of not ideal situation where naturally people who see this will react in some flavor of what you just did, of this is absurd. This is let them eat cake. You'd adapt in some way. So I think perhaps, though I sound generous in this particular situation. I think there have been numerous situations throughout the past 5 months where it's like, it might be something, you know, in person that comes across as not great, or messaging that is in fact deeply offensive to people. For instance, you know, the 100 day statement that talked about the devastation that's happened in the past 100 days and just didn't really acknowledge Palestinian suffering in any direct way. I think that's a better example of a more premeditated way where their PR shop or their communications shop, you know, had an opportunity to try to make inroads or to try to express that they really are concerned with everyone that's suffering from this. And that didn't hit the mark. So yes, I may sound generous here, but I think broadly speaking, this is, you know, an icon of a broader issue they've had of if they do indeed have great concern for the Palestinian people and even just the people who also feel concerned for them, as we've seen in the primary yesterday, if not from the protests in every major city in America, just from the primary results yesterday, statistically and very likely, a lot of those voters weren't quote unquote just Arab American or Muslim people, but people that just feel, you know, pretty outraged or sad or frustrated. And so that's a concern. That's definitely a concern.
Yeah, you are very generous. I just look at it as like they just don't care. Like they don't care.
Oh, yeah.
They
don't, yeah, yeah.
They really, I mean, they've shown with their actions they don't care.
Indeed.
They're like arming inside. But on top of that, they don't even care to like to try to like control the sort of theatrics of it, right?
Yes. Yeah.
At all. They're just like, whatever, we don't care. Like we just don't care. Let them die. We don't care. We don't care about voters. Who care? Like it's not, or we don't care. But to speak to more of like the sort of realistic political side of things, you did write this piece on the Democratic Majority for Israel, or DMFI, which is this lobbying group that, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I think they came into being in 20 or around the 2016 era, or maybe post. It was when it was becoming clear that like the issue of Israel was starting to split, become like a point of tension among the Democratic base, and that positions on this issue were changing. So this group basically, you know, acts as like an attack dog against progressive candidates, particularly if they happen to be candidates that are good on Palestine, though sometimes they've actually gone after candidates who have nothing to do with Israel-Palestine. And so I'm curious, you know, they are trying right now to intervene for Biden. They've also been attacking progressives. I'm just quoting from your piece on this. Mm-hmm. DMFI's attempt to bolster support for Biden's campaign comes as the group and its allies are also spending millions of dollars to attack members of Biden's party. The group's political action committee has also run ads attacking progressives in the 2024 primary races and spent millions. This is so funny. Sorry. StreamYard, all of these like StreamYard and Zoom and vMix, if you like do a thumbs up, it literally, yeah. Like, and then it pauses me. Wow, I didn't know StreamYard does it too. There, you guys saw it. StreamYard does it too. Anyways, the group's political action committee, DMFI PAC, has also run ads attacking progressives in the 2024 primary races and spent millions against progressive candidates in recent years. So I guess I'm, you know, can you talk a little bit about the significance of this group and why does it matter in this upcoming election?
Yeah. So to your point, DMFI, Democratic Majority for Israel, is founded, I think in 2019, in response, as you said, to polling that didn't seem to bode well for them. I think as well, you know, this was, of course, the ascendancy of members of the squad. So, yeah, in response to what they saw as maybe, you know, a rising tide that maybe would question the United States' sort of unconditional support for Israel. And yeah, they and also for the record, this was a piece I wrote with Akela Lacey as well. Lovely reporter. But yeah, they have and continue to dedicate lots and lots of money to challenging those who are challenging sort of longstanding assumptions of American foreign policy. And I think one thing that I found interesting about this is that some people who have maybe challenged the significance of the Michigan primary, for instance, have said, you know, still that's 80-something% of people who decide to vote for Biden. They were given an opportunity to protest and they didn't choose to do it. Of course, notwithstanding the fact that this was a 3-week-old campaign, shoestring budget, many people hadn't actually heard of it. Regardless of that, there's sort of an assumption that some of these people have that 80% of people in Michigan are still Zionists. Of course, that's like a reductive way of looking at it, but like 80% of people in Michigan like weren't sort of perturbed enough to make a different decision. And I think that sort of assumption of how people look at Israel and America's support for Israel is kind of, I think, it's a stronger assumption of how people in this country view Israel, because I think a lot of people in this country don't necessarily have like a hard line stance on Israel. And I think a lot of people also are comfortable with some of these assumptions or premises that people who are critical of Israel kind of operate on, such as that, you know, no country deserves necessarily unconditional aid, and that we should, you know, be sort of careful about that kind of thing, you know, basic sort of ideas like that. And I think groups like DMFI are I think really trying to harden those kinds of assumptions to make it seem kind of, you know, outlandish to think otherwise, for it to be radical. And so I think that's why, to your point, you start to see them go after maybe even some candidates that aren't necessarily, you know, saying that, you know, we should cut unconditional aid to Israel, or we should, you know, be very concerned with, you know, Palestinian human rights, even using the word Palestine, more like slighter gradations of this, such as, for instance, using the word Palestine, or even just saying, you know, whether any country should get unconditional aid, even, you know, sort of like more basic ideas like that, I think that they're going after too, because I think people are recognizing, or at least people who are concerned with maintaining sort of America's pro-Israel stance are maybe understanding more and more with these protests, with these primary results, and even just with sort of understanding the electorate more, that, you know, these assumptions that maybe have driven American foreign policy in the past, at least within the halls of power, are not necessarily, you know, enshrined into people's points of view. So I think that's one aspect that I see is sort of driving the urgency behind these groups.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then also, I mean, at this point, I think there was a poll done like it was more than a month ago by now, but it said something like 50% of Democratic voters, at least in this particular poll, believe Israel's committing genocide in Gaza. I mean, that is that's a very strong word to use.
Yeah,
and it demonstrates that at least half of this voting base, not only does the vast majority of Democrats support a ceasefire, at least half of them are calling it a genocide. And that's despite the fact that the entire corporate media apparatus is basically running cover for Israel. So it also shows that, you know, even if the New York Times says one thing and CNN is saying one thing, 50% of Democratic voters are still using the term genocide. I wanted to ask you about another aspect of this, and that is, you know, it's been a month since the International Court of Justice ruled that Israel's plausibly committing genocide in Gaza, and that Israel must prevent any more acts of possible genocide. And since that ruling over a month ago, Israel has killed thousands of more Palestinians. And that's by bombs and bullets. That doesn't even speak to how many are dying of starvation. And while doing that, Israeli soldiers and Israeli officials are still openly, publicly celebrating this and inciting genocide. So you wrote a piece basically crediting the U.S. for empowering Israel to continue. So I'm curious if you could just break down what exactly that means. How is the U.S. empowering Israel? It might seem obvious, but let's hear it.
Yeah. So I think one aspect of this is just to your point, when the International Court of Justice rules something, even just the idea that someone is plausibly committing genocide, you never want to plausibly be committing genocide. That's something you don't want to plausibly be doing, naturally. I wouldn't want to be doing that personally. I'd like to certainly not be doing that.
You heard it here first, guys.
And so for the United States, which, you know, in many ways, regardless of administration, mostly in modern history, you know, says that they respect international law, the international order, that they want to not only respect it, but maintain and support it and be an active participant in it. For them to not take a ruling like this, not just at face value, but even more seriously, to be on the front lines of trying to mediate and ensure that that plausibly becomes a certainly not, that itself at a basic level is revealing as to how the United States is operating with this. More particularly, throughout this, even before, during, and after that ICJ ruling, there's sort of a long list of what the Biden administration has done on the international stage with regards to their stance on Israel and making it very clear where they stand. So spanning as early back as, I believe, a few weeks into the conflict, into the war on Gaza in October, the administration vetoed a UN resolution for humanitarian pause. Shortly thereafter, I believe in December, they vetoed the first UN resolution for a ceasefire and hostage release. And then on two separate instances, they, using an authority they have, but maybe an authority that I think more and more people are questioning, to send Israel hundreds of millions of dollars of weapons to approve a transfer to them without congressional approval. They then shortly thereafter voted no on a UN vote for a ceasefire and hostage release that I believe was 153-10, as in 153 nations were in favor of it. 10, presumably some who were satellite nations of the US, voted against it. And then days before the ICJ case, you had numerous spokespeople for the administration attack or undermine the ICJ case, as many people might have seen, sort of famous quotes from the State Department, from the White House press people who called it, even as far as, you know, without any basis in fact whatsoever, which goes back to your early point of their messaging on this. You know, you can surely undermine something without saying there's no basis in fact whatsoever, particularly when the ICJ case has lots of pages just that are citations of Israel's own leaders. It's kind of tough to call that without any basis in fact whatsoever. But anyhow, they then, of course, cut money to UNRWA, the UN agency that aids Palestinians, on accusations that a very small percentage of their staff may have been involved in the attacks on October 7th, which then, of course, led to many other nations, a cascading effect, to also do so. And since then, lots of nations have come out and admitted that they did not see any evidence or they did not see enough evidence to conclude such a thing. Or in fact, even that a document that's been going around does not show evidence of such a fact. And then finally, of course, again, the latest veto just recently on the ceasefire and hostage release. Sorry, that was such a long list. But I think that just goes to show that it's been a frequent pattern both before and after the ICJ trial of, at least publicly, in the most public way possible, not just communicate to us, but to communicate to the rest of the world about where the U.S. stands, their policy hasn't sort of been, no, but here's another alternative. It sort of has been, but they've never really actively advocated for those alternatives either. Like, for instance, last week, after they vetoed yet another ceasefire and hostage release resolution, they said that they had an alternative that you know, it used the word ceasefire the first time, and it seems to, in some ways, preview what perhaps is their temporary ceasefire, perhaps coming in the works. Nonetheless, you know, they were in no rush to actually vote on their alternative resolution. But even before that, beyond that, there hasn't been that much of a concerted effort to show that, beyond them saying we're working in private, to actually prove that, especially because over and over again, the sort of leaks that we've gotten about their private conversations to show that, you know, they really care is, you know, Biden called Netanyahu a swear word and so on. And then, of course, you know, that's side by side with a few weeks prior of them sending them weapons or vetoing another resolution. So those kinds of things are tough when it's like, okay, even if that's true, sure. I mean, you can call someone a bad word, that's good and fine, but giving them hundreds of million dollars without any conditions, I mean, that's a whole other thing. I think if I was in that bargain, I'd take being called a bad word if, you know, you're going to give me that much.
Yeah, right. It's all theatrics. That's the theatrics. That's the theatrics. So one thing that you have been doing is you've been, I don't know how you can stomach it, but you've been going to the State Department press briefings and asking Matt Miller, who I don't know how he sleeps at night, but he somehow manages to, because he seems like he is well-rested when he does these State Department press briefings every day and fields questions, basically like justifying everything Israel does. But you've been asking him some tough questions. So I wanted to play a couple clips from that, because I do appreciate that you are going there and doing this. I don't know how you maintain your composure, but you do. So good for you. So here is actually you bringing up, you asking about this active duty service member, Aaron Brushnell, who lit himself on fire outside the Israeli embassy to protest the genocide in Gaza and subsequently died. It was a pretty extreme act of protest. And so let's hear what Matt Miller had to say.
And on Aaron Bushnell, per my colleague's question just now, specifically, I was wondering if there's any concern with regards to him saying, you know, as he said, I'm an active duty member of the United States Air Force, and I will no longer be complicit in genocide. I'm curious if there's been any conversations about that kind of claim being made by a member of the armed service before. Of course, he commits such a...
I think I should defer to the Pentagon for an answer to that question.
And then any updates on Hinder Jobs, the investigation in the killing of Hinder Jobs' family and the paramedics sent to save her?
I don't have an update. My understanding is that the investigation is ongoing.
So the investigation's ongoing, you guys. Just to remind people, Hind Rajab, that was the little girl who was basically like on the phone begging for help, and nobody could get to her in Gaza City, I think. And then she was like killed, and we heard her screams. It was really horrific, and her whole family was basically dead around her in a car. Just one of so many instances where that happened, but this happened to be, you know, recorded on the telephone. And so there was that. Before I move on to any other clips, I'm just curious if you had any thoughts to add about the fact that there was this self-immolation that took place. And obviously he's deferred to the Pentagon. Something tells me the Pentagon wouldn't have much to say about why he did it.
Yeah.
But go ahead. What do you have to say about that?
I think the Pentagon might've been asked also numerous times about this, but I know at least, I think my memory serves, there's so much I'm trying to keep track of, but I think at least on one instance that they were asked, I think they also deferred then to the police. But I'm perhaps they might've had a statement too. I'm not sure. On the State Department, as I alluded to in that clip too, he was asked right before, I wanted to ask specifically about what Bushnell had said. He was asked right before me by another reporter about the case generally and if it was going to impact US policy. And, you know, to be clear, like he did, you know, express condolences, sympathy, you know, sort of the bare minimum of something, you know, so horrific. And he had said that, and perhaps, you know, I might've just missed him saying something like this before, but he had said, we take this and all acts of protest into consideration into how we're sort of shaping policy, and that we are thinking of like, if we should be looking at things a certain way. And of course, you know, he did sort of wrap this into a broader statement about taking in protests from all sides. Like they're hearing very loudly from people who are very adamantly pro-Israel and also those who are much more skeptical. But he did say that, which I thought was interesting, because I don't know if I've heard sort of a direct acknowledgement of protest like that. But maybe it just felt more significant because it came in response to this. I mean, I'm sure they might have been asked in response to, for instance, the very large protest that took place in DC numerous times. But I thought that was kind of interesting that he said that in such a way. But yeah, with regards to the specific quotes, which I was hoping that, you know, we would get some sort of color as to how they're reacting to, of course, you know, a member of their own armed services saying something like that, they did defer. I have not been going to the Pentagon briefings. I surely would like to, but if anyone watching is a journalist who goes there, if you want to follow up and ask specifically about that, I'd be curious.
I mean, about Aaron Bushnell though, I mean, I think it definitely says something about a certain shift in consciousness among at least some Americans based on what they've witnessed the past 5 months. I mean, lighting yourself on fire is a pretty big thing to do, especially he died. He literally just like died to make a point about Gaza. And he was making bigger points about the American military too, and what America supports. Mm-hmm. So I do like wonder if that's being underestimated by those in positions of power, that there is a certain fervor that is being sort of like stirred because of the outrage from watching this, and also just watching the sort of like open hypocrisy, the open double standards in such a shocking way. You also asked another question of Matt Miller about sexual assault allegations. And so for those who don't know, I just want to specify what I'm talking about here before I show the clip of you questioning Matt Miller on it. There was a UN report put together by UN experts who basically looked into violations against Palestinian women and girls. And I'm just going to give you some of the highlights from this report. I'm going to read directly from it. Palestinian women and girls have reportedly been arbitrarily executed in Gaza, often together with family members, including their children. That's one. Palestinian women detained in Gaza were allegedly kept in a cage in the rain and cold without food. This is a quote from one of the experts. "We are particularly distressed by reports that Palestinian women and girls in detention have also been subjected to multiple forms of sexual assault, such as being stripped naked and searched by male Israeli army officers. At least two female Palestinian detainees were reportedly raped, while others were reportedly threatened with rape and sexual violence." The experts also noted that photos of female detainees in degrading circumstances were reportedly taken by the Israeli army and uploaded online. And they expressed concern that an unknown number of Palestinian women and children, including girls, have reportedly gone missing after contact with the Israeli army in Gaza. Quote, "There are disturbing reports of at least one female infant forcibly transferred by the Israeli army into Israel and of children being separated from their parents, whose whereabouts remain unknown." So these are just some highlights of the horrors that are alluded to in this report. And I mean, I want to remind everybody the reaction in the media and by this administration of accusations of sexual assaults against Israeli women on October 7th and the way that that has been portrayed and reported on and covered and talked about. And then I want you to compare it to the kinds of reactions we get about this.
Thank you, Matt. God bless you. There have been now at least 6 documented instances depicting members of the IDF displaying or rifling through women's underwear. And of course, that's just on camera. Soldiers have, as we've seen, stripped and tortured Palestinians. There have been a reported history of soldiers abusing children that they've detained even before October 7th. And of course, you know, investigations need to be pursued, but still given, you know, all that we've seen from Israeli forces just up to this point, what's the U.S. government doing in response now, given the UN experts' alarm at credible allegations of human rights violations and sexual violence committed against Palestinians?
We make clear to the government of Israel that we expect them to behave consistent with the laws of war and consistent with their own rules of engagement. And we have seen the Israeli military come out and say it is conducting its own investigations into reports of soldiers who have failed to comply with either of those two sets of rules. And that's appropriate. And that's what you expect a professional military to do. And we expect those investigations to proceed. And if appropriate, hold the responsible parties accountable.
And then a few more. And then really to that investigation, then related as well to the Biden administration's memo a couple weeks ago regarding this kind of thing of ensuring that, you know, American military aid isn't contributing to these kinds of violations. What sort of conversations are being had right now to make sure that these accountability measures, if they need to be taken, are taken, you know, on time, expeditiously? I know, for instance, like the assurances for the memo, those need to be done within 45 days. So what's the conversations like around
it? It is the exact kind of conversation I just detailed in response to your last questions, which is we have very frank and candid conversations with the government of Israel about this. But again, the government of Israel has itself come out and said publicly, you've seen the head of the IDF say that they are conducting investigations. You've seen, I think it's the chief attorney or the chief lawyer, I'm going to get the exact title wrong, come out with a report in the last week or so of alleged violations and say that there are members of the IDF who did not behave in accordance with Israeli rules of engagement and that there are investigations ongoing. We think those are appropriate. That's what we expect our military to do when American servicemen or servicewomen don't behave consistent with the laws of war, consistent with rules of engagement. It's what we expect the Israeli military to do. It's what we would expect of any professional military operating anywhere in the world.
God, I mean, okay, so go ahead. What do you think about that answer? Go ahead. If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear the rest, you can access it by becoming a Breakthrough News member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews.